And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Yes, indeed. Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past nine on this Tuesday, the 13th of August, and you're very welcome along to another 9 to noon show. How are you all keeping out there across the Northwest or wherever you are listening to us from? We'd love to hear where you're listening to us from. You can get in touch with us with that information, if you wish, and your social security number, nominee Weston. You can get in touch with us with that information, and also to have your comments and your say on topics on the show today, or indeed to raise your own. 086 60 25000 086 60 25000, that's the WhatsApp or text number, or give us a call in 074 91 25000 074 91 25000, or emails to comments at highlandradio.com. if you want to watch the show, we're streaming live on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch on your smart screen TV or your Fire Stick if that suits you at home, and we're on Facebook as well, Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport, and on the X platform, Highland Radio, streaming successfully. Unlike Elon Musk, who owns the plant, last night he had a conversation with Donald Trump. Managed to listen to a couple of clips this morning. Strange, two billionaires patting each other on the back, but there you go. That's the world we live in nowadays. Maybe you listened to it and you enjoyed it. I don't know. If you did listen to it, you hardly listened to us now, because I think it ran on until 3 o'clock in the morning. Right, okay, so as I say, get in contact with us with whatever you want. And also, people often contact me through my own social media, which is great too. I love to help where I can. Sometimes the messaging can be quite busy, but I don't see it all. But there's one thing I've noticed of late, and it seems to be particularly from the Inishowen area, is people in very desperate housing situations. I've been contacted by maybe four or five different people. Often it's mums, to be honest with you, who have children, and either the house they're living in, renting, is got mica and the landlord needs them out to do the house up, or maybe they have the landlord's upping the rent and they can't afford the rent that the landlord's looking for. We heard one such case last week and they're moving out. But there just is, and I would say it's a tiny percentage of people that would reach out to me, but there does seem to be a growing situation of families being asked to move out of homes because of rent increases, or because of maybe defective concrete and remedial work taking place. And it's causing incredible amounts of distress and anxiety. So I don't know what we can do about it, but certainly we might talk about it down the line. But I mean, if you're in that position and you want to reach out, please feel free to do so. But there's a couple of people have already contacted me, and I'm still back and forth with them as to what path they wish to take from it. But it's a very difficult situation. People in desperate, dire straits. I don't know why that came into my head. I just glanced at my phone and it reminded me of some of the conversations over the weekend. Let's have a look at the newspapers. The Irish Independent talks about EV uptakes and some interesting statistics in Donegal, and I'll get to those in a moment. But motorists in the commuter belt are slowly moving towards electric vehicles, but efforts to get rural drivers out of petrol and diesel cars are stalling. Those who are shifting are opting for hybrid rather than fully electric, and government targets of having 1 million EVs on the road by 2030 now seem dubious. They were dubious the day they were announced, a ridiculous target, and I think even the government's given up on that, if the truth be told. In one rural county, EVs make up just 1 in 48 new registrations in the first 6 months of this year. There are currently 110,000 EVs in Irish roads. Hybrids made up almost a third of new cars registered in most counties in the first half of this year. In more than half of counties, 1 in 10 or fewer were EVs. Now, just looking at some of the Donegal statistics, but I'd just be interested because, you know, a lot of cars that people favour, you can't get them in diesel any longer, or you can't get them in straight diesel, for example. It's a soft hybrid. I'm not sure, are they counted as hybrid or are they counted as diesels? But anyway, in Donegal, 7.2% of new cars were EVs. Fossil fuels, ICE engines effectively, 67.8, that run solely on petrol or diesel. But I mean, if you're looking at your Nissan, you can't get them in diesel, so they're going to be petrol. Hybrid, interestingly, 25%. 25% of new cars were hybrid. Now, that's higher than most other rural countries. In Leitrim, hybrid 17%, Sligo 22%, Mayo 21%, Roscommon 17%. So down sort of the western side of the country, we seem to be favouring hybrids more. But we are lower in full AVs, 7.2% in Donegal, then in Leitrim 7.9%, 11.2%, 7.4% in Mayo, 3.4% in Roscommon. It's 10.6 in Galway, Longford 7.7. But I think just a cursory glance around there, I think we've the second lowest uptake of EVs, or maybe the third lowest behind Monaghan and also Roscommon. But what's that down to? I genuinely think it is down to the charging infrastructure. Because we spoke to a dealer in the past, this was going back 3 or 4 years ago, and people love the electric car because they're fantastic cars to drive. They've got fantastic torque, acceleration. But people are worried about charging them, and there's not enough chargers, simple as that. And to the point where I'm kind of almost dubious about doing any future interviews about the charging infrastructure, because I've done maybe 3 or 4 or 5, whether it be the government ESB talking about millions upon millions of euro being invested in the EV charging infrastructure. And yet, where are these chargers? Where is this charging infrastructure? So we keep doing these interviews and people go, oh, right, they're doing something about it. But these charging stations don't appear anywhere. So, I mean, in the Wild Atlantic Way, could you drive the Wild Atlantic Way in an EV car successfully, comfortably? I'm willing to try it. I don't have an EV car, but I'd be willing to try it. But anyway, so that's it. We are, I just wonder if it's the cars that we favour are more likely to come in hybrid now, or are we fond of the hybrids in Donegal? As I say, we've a huge uptake in them. Not a huge uptake, more of an uptake than other rural counties. But we've one of the lowest, third lowest, I believe it is, in EV, full EV uptakes. On to the Irish Times now. And nearly 1,100 deportation orders have been issued to asylum seekers over the last 6 months, with plans for charter planes to enforce removals now at an advanced stage. Still at an advanced stage. They were at an advanced stage a couple of months ago. The number of deportation orders is increasing amid a continuing effort by the government to toughen up immigration policies. Taoiseach Simon Harris has stated on a number of occasions this year that there is a need to focus on faster processing times and effective deportations for asylum seekers who do not have a right to reside in the state. If the current trend continues, the state is on track for a record level of deportation orders in 2024, potentially well in excess of 2,000, which would be the highest number in the last 4 years. But at the moment, if the truth be told, people receive a deportation order and just crack on. And oftentimes the government don't actually know where they are. Enforced deportations are now up 128%, and voluntary returns are up 157% to mid-July. Now, the percentages sound impressive. The actual numbers, which the paper don't print on the front page, are so low that, you know, going from 13 to 39 is a 300% increase, just as an example of a figure. What do you think about this? There seems to be more of a pressure on women to sort of adopt traditional roles. There's actually, I mentioned Elon Musk at the top of the show. He and others are very frustrated, it seems, by the low birth rates in certain countries. And in fairness, it is collapsing. And in Ireland, the birth rate year on year dropped really, really quite significantly, one of the most significant drops. So we are having less babies, but it seems to be the pressure is on women to become trad wives as a trend. And I don't know what you think out there, particularly women. I'm more interested in what women have to say in relation to this, or fellas for that matter. But anyway, it's a social media trend encouraging women to return to homemaking gender roles as trad wives. But apparently some feel it's undermining decades of progress and harming women. The trad wife trend began in Britain in 2020 and quickly spread across the Atlantic. While many of its original proponents have now shunned the movement, younger influencers are continuing to promote the joys of relying on a husband for financial support, being submissive to him and staying at home to prepare meals and shoulder all the domestic duties. Now, the problem we have in this day and age is that, and we talked about this on the show last week, you can take a position on social media that you might not actually agree with, right? But it gets views and it gets clicks and it gets likes and it gets plays, and you get money from that. So you could actually become, I could become an influencer in trying to get women to be trad wives. I might not want that to be the case, right? But there's money in it. So I could sort of say, well, listen, it's just a job. It's a role I'm playing. So really what's happening on social media is not necessarily reflective of what's happening on live because it's monetized. But anyway, in a TikTok video with over 1.6 million views, which is actually really quite small for TikTok, trad wife influencer SD Williams 25 from Richmond, Virginia, said trad wives believe their place is in the home while the husband provides for the family. Victoria Litt, a Texican whose TikTok account has 52,000 followers, recently posted that the number one rule for trad wives to remember: a man's home is his castle, so he should be treated as a king. He's working a stressful job, maybe working long hours so we can provide for you and the family. So he rightfully deserves peace. He's your king and you're his queen. That is your duty, she said. But a mental health charity believes this is actually, it's harmful to women. And it sounds harmful to women, I think. But anyway, what do you think about that? Would you be a proponent of those values? Would you be in favour of them? Do you think it's right? Do you think it's wrong? 086 60 25,000. The fella that allegedly made threats to Simon Harris, he's appeared in court. A man appeared in court yesterday charged with threatening to kill Taoiseach Simon Harris and his family. Patrick Grealish, 48, of Lettermullen, Galway, appeared before Judge Gerard Furlong at a special sitting of Galway District Court yesterday afternoon. Mr. Grealish is accused of making a threat to kill or cause serious harm to Simon Harris and his family. Detective Sergeant Eamon O'Neill of the Special Detective Unit gave evidence of arrest, charge and caution. Mr. Grealish says thank you very much to the judge when granted bail. He was granted legal aid and bailed on his own bond of €500. Ukraine has adopted a new approach. They are pushing into Russia. And I presume the idea is that in the event of some sort of a peace deal or negotiations, hopefully we're not a million miles away from that, given the incredible loss of life that's occurring in Russia and Ukraine, they've moved into Russia. And I suppose if they can go in there and hold a certain amount of land, the idea being that if it ever comes down to a negotiation, I presume, I'm not even an armchair general, but presumably then there's a bargaining chip, right? So they can say, well, you give us back part of our country and we'll give you back the part that we're occupying. But about 100,000 Russian civilians have scrambled for safety from a shock Ukrainian cross-border incursion that's overwhelmed Vladimir Putin's defences. Hundreds of Russian soldiers, including officers, have been forced to surrender as humiliated President Putin tried to play down the blow. Over 11,000 citizens in Belgorod, neighbouring the main point of the invasion in the Kursk region, have been told to flee by Russian officials. It is on top of the huge number of refugees who've escaped their Kursk homes, with even more being urged to leave. An official in the region admitted to reporters it'd become a very tense situation. Now, the remarkable situation we find ourselves in at the moment is that you've got like American armoured vehicles and weaponry from Europe, but particularly I think it's the American angle on it which seems pretty significant. In Russia, on Russian territory, driving through, there was an awful, there was awful descriptions of these military vehicles surprising Russian soldiers and just driving straight through them and opening fire on them. I know they're soldiers and I know it's a war, but still, the imagery seems incredibly shocking. But you've got American armored vehicles inside Russia at the moment now, and you do wonder, given the weaponry. Maybe it's rules of war and maybe it's my naivety, or maybe someone out there can answer. I mean, Vladimir Putin has weapons at his disposal which could flatten Kyiv, for an example. Is it rules of war that he doesn't do that? Is it that they've set the battle lines that it's mostly a ground war and an air war with certain type of weaponry? Because he quite literally could flatten Kyiv or any other city for that matter, I presume. But he doesn't. So maybe it's the rules of this war. I don't know. I'm a bit naive in that regard and don't dig too deep into it. But has that ever tweaked your curiosity as to why he doesn't clearly use the weaponry available to him maybe it's because of the civilians or what have you. We could order the evacuation of a city and then threaten to flatten it. I don't know. That sounds terribly insensitive, but I'm genuinely curious as to why, when he's got much greater firepower, he's not going down that route. But I presume maybe it's down to some sort of a rules. But on a much more happy note, more than 20,000 jubilant Irish fans turned O'Connell Street into a sea of green to welcome our Olympic heroes home yesterday. Huge crowds gathered outside the GPO in Dublin city centre from early morning, anxious to catch a glimpse of our sporting stars after they jetted in from Paris following our most successful games ever. Brilliant pictures, and I think some commentator described it as like St. Patrick's Day, but without the booze and drizzle. But there you go. Great scenes. So, okay, it is time for us to move on the programme. We'll be right back. Now, there is still major questions over the future of a GP service out of Ardrahr. We're joined on the programme to talk more about this now by Deputy Thomas Pringle. Good morning, Thomas. Thanks for your time.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. Now, I don't know how long ago it is, but it seemed like a long time ago. I think the HSE said something along the lines that they were committed to providing or recruiting a GP to service this area, yet here we are. What is the situation and what do we understand at the moment?
Well, as I understand it at the moment, the situation is that Dr. Marielle Sweeney, who's the GP, current GP in Ardrahr, is due to retire on the 22nd of August. And to date, she has had no correspondence from the HSE in relation to what is happening with the practice and whether it's going to be filled from that time. I haven't been able to get any response from them either, despite them almost 2 weeks ago telling me that the response was on its way and that it would be with me. It hasn't arrived yet. And I think that's just a very bad form and very bad practice from the HSE. And to leave a community wondering and like this, and right up to the jaws of when the GP is going to retire, I think it's not on, and this day and age it shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, so I mean, we don't really know if the HSE issued a holding statement to keep everyone happy and ticking over, or if there's actual activity going on in the background to back that statement up. We don't know because they're not telling us any more details.
They won't tell us, and they won't know. I understand that there hasn't been interviews yet, but I don't know is that correct or not. But that's what I've been informed. But we just don't know because the HSE won't say. And that's unacceptable. I think, you know, if the HSE are having difficulties in recruiting or whatever, or getting applications, they should be coming out and saying that, and it should be a straightforward thing to say that and let everybody know what this situation is, because then people can deal with it when they know what's likely to happen. But leaving everybody hanging and wondering, it's unfair, and it's I think it's unprofessional as well from the HSE's point of view.
Yeah, and I mean, it's all right me saying it and you saying it. It's really quite regrettable that the current GP feels that they have to say it. As the current GP, some form of communication from the HSE would be appropriate or appreciated, sorry. It would also be helpful to my staff if they had some idea whether they'll be re-employed by any successful candidates. You know, so what is the sort of the terms of the job that's being advised by the HSE or advertised, sorry?
Yeah, I mean, I know that the GP services are have some sort of the GPs are individuals and their individual practices and stuff like that there, but the HSE has a role involved in that, and the HSE is the most important customer of a local GP in as well, and they have a very strong responsibility, and they have a legal responsibility to the medical care patients in the area, and that they have to respond in relation to their treatment and their care. And that's why the HSE is responsible for recruiting GPs and stuff like that as well, is because of the medical care patients and the public service patients. You know, so they have a responsibility and they need to live up to that. And unfortunately, we're kind of talking in a vacuum because we don't know what the situation is, because the HSE won't tell us.
Yeah, you see, and just in relation to that, Thomas, we had it recently with St. Joseph's there in Ballybuffet. Like, I don't want to over-amplify my influence, but a lot of people listen to this show, and when we have conversations like this, we're kind of feeding the uncertainty or maybe anxieties, okay? I would love to work with the HSE, even to get out in front of this stuff and get proper information. I'm sure you would too. There's no advantage to you in highlighting the concerns of your constituents. It'd be far better if you could bring to them something from the HSE and say, and by the way, that's what the HSE says. We'll give them a couple of weeks, but I'll hold them to it and I'll come back to you with more information. But we don't get that. This is the response to our concern, our queries from the HSE. I'm not editing it. This is quite literally it. The HSE are currently in an active recruitment process to fill the position. Sinead, that's it. So
that's more of a response than I got.
Well, there you go. But that you have it as well. So my point is that work with us. You know, there's a massive communications department there. Work with the media, work with the local representatives, get the information out early. Don't drip it, because we'll probably get another press release tomorrow with a little bit more detail. And it doesn't benefit anyone. There's no advantage in it for me or you, and certainly not in the public, who are the most important in relation to this. And I think the GP who's currently there at the moment, very legitimate, very simple questions that deserve an answer.
Yeah, particularly from the current GP's point of view, and this is the same in every GP area, that person has given a commitment to the area for many years, and then at the end of their career or their time is to be left in this limbo of not knowing. And also that they're looking to, they're going to retire or whatever, and they're probably thinking, you know, should they be retiring at this stage?
100%.
You know, are people going to be left in the lurch at that time? Yeah. And that's the problem, and that's why that... the HSE should be coming out and saying things. And you're right, you know, I mean, we shouldn't be left in the lurch. We shouldn't be, like, it makes me look like a fool when people contact you from the area and you say, look, I'm trying to get an answer from the HSE. They won't respond. And that kind of stuff, and that doesn't do us any good either. And we'd like to be able to say to the two people, yes, the HSE are recruiting. There's interviews taking place next week, or there isn't, or something has happened and they're moving on with it, and that's happening. And it's very simple. Mm. I mean, I
could write it for them. The HSE is currently in an active recruitment process to fill. This is me guessing what they should say. Fully active process to fill the position. We hope someone will be appointed as soon as possible. It is hoped that the successful candidate will have the full use of the Ardrar Health Centre to continue, or perhaps even to expand services, and the HSE will be fully committed to supporting them in their role, and also hopefully that the new GP, when appointed, will meet with the current staff at the earliest opportunity to allay any concerns they might have on their futures. I mean, that's not what they've said, right? But yeah. That would sort of say, right, okay, they're serious about this. They've committed to this health centre. They've listened to the previous GP. They're listening to the local public reps, and they're listening to the public. Instead, they kind of insult us with a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 word press release.
Yeah, it'll be very easy to say that, Craig, and it'll be very... You know, I have no doubt that there are people in the HSE working hard at trying to resolve this, or whatever, if there is an issue, but we don't even know if there is an issue. And, you know, and that... So, I mean, I don't think there would be anybody would have any criticism for them to come out and say, look, we're working hard at this, we're trying to sort this out, and we'll be working as soon as we can. And that's all anybody's looking for. But if, when you get a complete vacuum and you don't know what's going to, then the rumour mill takes over and everything happens then, and then you get public media, social media and stuff like that, they're taking over and everything as well. And you know, the completely wrong story might be.
And also too, what I think would be very telling is how advanced are any plans, interim plans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because that could be quite telling too, as to the commitment to get a new GP in there. I would not be surprised if interim plans are already in place as to how providing GP care in that area will be covered into the future. You know what I mean? Mm. We don't. I don't. Yeah. No, I'm on about in terms of, it's going to be out of Glenties. Is it going to be out of this? Do you know what I mean? The contingency plan probably is more firm than the recruitment plan. Okay. Well, listen, Thomas, thanks for your time. As I say, you know, that's all we have, that press release. All we can do is keep the pressure on. But for now, Independent Deputy Thomas Pringle, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, bye-bye. So that press release, the HSE are currently in an active recruitment process to fill the position. So people in and around the Ardrar area, I wish I could give you better news. The current GP, this is what they wrote on the Ardrar Health Centre website. As you know, I'll be working my last day as GP in Ardrar on the 22nd of this month. I've been in touch with the HSE, but have yet to be informed if interviews have been held for the post of GP in Ardrar, and if so, is there a successful candidate? In my contacts with the HSE, I've always stressed that the premises at Ardrar Health Centre would be at the disposal of any successful candidate. As the current GP, some form of communication from the HSE would be appreciated. It would be helpful to my staff if they had some idea whether they'll be re-employed by any successful candidate. And as I say, the response, the HSE are currently in an active recruitment process to fill the position. So that's the vacuum in which we have to talk in 086 60 25,000. A texter says, sure, landlords not renting to locals anymore. Look what happened, the woman in Buncrana. Landlord put a rent up from 540 to 1,250. I think it went up 140%, so maybe your figures are right there. The woman can't find anywhere else, so she and her two children will be homeless. She works for the HSE, and because she's working, doesn't get any social welfare help. But even the social welfare help is not enough. One of the ladies, or gentlemen, I won't divulge that I'm in contact at the moment. I'll just double check with them if it's okay for me to read their story, because it is another desperate situation. Morning, Greg. What's the resale value of these second-hand electric vehicles? Can any dealer come on and answer these questions? Yes, of course. There's a lot of misinformation out there in relation to the longevity of the batteries, the resale value. I'm not here to promote or plug them, right? Don't get me wrong. Nor would I diesel, petrol, whatever type of engine. But there was one high-profile dealer come out and said that she wouldn't deal with them. But the market has to settle, because there's not a massive secondhand market of them, because they're relatively new. But any dealers out there that are listening, perhaps, and want to talk about the resale value, quell any of those concerns, you know our details. Right, we are going to our next guest in a moment, but we do have to take a very quick break. Stay right where you are. The Gardaí are urging people not to rely on social media for finding student accommodation, as they revealed that 12 victims suffered a combined loss of over €20,000 through accommodation scams last month. And we were talking about housing generally a little earlier on, and when there is a particular desperation in a certain area, there are people who are very good at what they do, not to give them any credit whatsoever, but they're full-time con people, and they will try and exploit any crisis or shortage, and not least student accommodation. And I think particularly for those of us in rural areas, where we could be talking about Galway and Dublin, are we going to drive up and down to check out accommodation every time, or are we going to wing it and say, right, I saw the pictures, I believe you, I trust you, we land down with our bags and our bank account could be empty and no accommodation to be seen. We're joined on the programme now by Detective Superintendent Michael Cryan, who, it's a timely warning actually, because I think now is the time people are sort of going to be starting to look in earnest at student accommodation. Good morning, Michael. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity.
Right, okay. So what is happening to those of us who are falling victim to these scams? Is it that we are relying on social media, on pictures, on trust in mankind or humankind to secure this accommodation? What's happening?
I suppose a little bit of everything. This type of crime, it happens all year round, but these are really the high-risk months, August, September. For the first 6 months of this year, this reports of this crime are down 11%, so that's good news. But it, as I said, these are the high-risk months because students are returning to college and there are new students as well, as you said yourself, from rural areas looking for accommodation in the cities. So generally speaking, it's victims are seeing ads on social media. The ads are offering, shall we say, very good terms, very good location, good, and they're looking for a quick deposit and they want it now to secure it. And people are paying the quick deposits and then they're realising that the accommodation doesn't exist, or the person has taken a deposit from numerous people and or is not entitled to sublet or let the accommodation in the first place.
And the figures we're talking about are significant to an individual, but they're clever enough, aren't they, that they don't pitch it so high as that to be a red flag. So we have the average victim last month losing €1,729 each, which I say is a significant sum. One person losing over €3,500 to a fraudster. Are these exclusively or mainly deposits that have been paid to, you know, make sure that the accommodation is secured before someone else gets it?
Yeah, that was actually a snapshot of 1 week in the month of July. Not all those victims are students. Some of them were people who were moving to Ireland looking to secure accommodation, were moving to work or to go to college here as well. Some were actually Irish victims looking for accommodation for holidays. So they're a different, they're a mishmash of everything. Generally speaking, with the students, it's a month's rent in advance or a security or something like that is what they lose. So figures can change depending on what the type of fraud it is, shall we say.
Yeah. And when do they generally realise that they have been defrauded of, say, for instance, a deposit in the first month's rent? Is it when they land down to collect a key, or do they just disappear, the person they're in contact with, once the money's been deposited? Or what's the story there?
Again, it can be, unfortunately, it can be sometimes when the victim turns up at the accommodation and discover, or they turn up to meet the landlord, shall we say, and he doesn't turn up or she doesn't turn up and there's no keys, or the keys handed over don't work, or they arrive at accommodation to discover there's people already in it, or they arrive at accommodation to discover it's not for rent in the first place. And we have had cases of people who move to Ireland and arrive into Ireland prepared to start working, shall we say, or go to college and arrive at accommodation. And it's at that stage they realise that they have been defrauded and they have no accommodation and they're in a strange country.
Rather than maybe go through what the do's and don'ts are in terms of trying to get accommodation on social media, do you want to go down that route, or are you at the point now where you're saying, look, don't look for property on social media? There are letting agents out there that you can actually speak to a human about. Go that route.
Yeah, there's a number of red flags. First of all, we would advise people to look out for. One is where the accommodation is only advertised through a social media advertisement. So if you see something on social media, have a look to see is it advertised elsewhere. It's a red flag. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with it, but it is a red flag. How payment is sought as well. How the person, you know, if they'll only contact you via WhatsApp or some kind of messaging service, don't want to speak to you, or they have some kind of excuses always for not meeting you, that they're out of the country or their X or their Y, that's a red flag as well. Or if they're looking for a bank transfer to a bank account outside the jurisdiction, or they're looking to be paid in some kind of vouchers or cryptocurrency, again, they're red flags.
And ironically, also, if they seem too trustful of you, you actually want them to be checking up on you, don't you, really? Because that would be the norm.
That absolutely, yeah. Like if you were renting an accommodation to somebody, you would be checking out on them. You'd be making sure they are who they say they are as well. Because you don't want to be conned, or you don't want to be renting your apartment out to somebody who's untrustworthy. So again, it's almost a red flag if it's too easy. If straight away they say, yes, this is it, you just pay me, and, you know, no questions asked, it's a red flag. Mm-hmm. And the advice we would give is you need to do your research on the advertisement. Don't trust the picture, the ad you have been seeing or have been shown. And ideally, you use recognized letting agencies. Or you deal with the college, talk to the student union in the college. Or there's loads of websites as well which give very good advice, the likes of the Residential Tenancy Board's website, student unions themselves. You have the Banking and Payments Federation, their Fraud Smart website, the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission, CPPC. As I said, all of the universities as well. Ideally, you know, you use it, as I said, you use a recognised letting agency, and you protect your data as well, protect your personal data.
Because you can imagine the scenario around the kitchen table, mum or dad on the laptop, and maybe the student over their shoulder, or those roles could be reversed. You know, we can't let this one go. This is perfect. It's within walking distance. Come on, they're only looking for this, that and done. That's that where the time pressure is there and something seems so good to be true. I think that's where we have to pause for thought, isn't it? Detective Superintendent Michael Cryan, do you think social media companies are doing enough in relation to this, I wonder? Because I do note there was one property here in West Donegal that was up for a Airbnb, and I think people were defrauded, mostly from Northern Ireland, out of tens of thousands of euro. And the advert sat there for months on end. Even there was actually a campaign sprung out of the North on Facebook to try and remove this ad. I just wonder, or maybe we'd be just barking up the wrong tree to say, could we ever expect the social media companies to be a bit more responsible in allowing these type of adverts on their platforms? Or do we have to just rely on ourselves to see the fraud?
I can't really comment on individual cases involving individual social media companies. Again, I suppose they have to be informed. They have to be made aware of them by people as well. I wouldn't know enough, and I wouldn't like to comment on their approach to these things.
No problem. But the advice is there, and we do appreciate it, and it's timely, as I say, at the moment. Detective Superintendent Michael Cryan, thank you so much for your time. Now, We've got a quiz running all week on this programme, the 9 till noon show. It's in advance of National Heritage Week. That runs from the 17th to the 25th of August. And on the show today, we've got two family heritage cards. They're valued at €90 each to give away. These cards offer access for one family, that's two adults and up to five children, to over 45 OPW managed heritage sites across the country. Now, you can visit any or all attractions as often as you like during the Heritage Cards validity period. See heritageweek.ie for all event listings for County Donegal and across the country, indeed. To win, which heritage place are we talking about? Sitting beside Garton, so peace and so still. A house and a garden given to us by the artist Derek Hill. So where are we talking about? I'm going to put peaceful in here instead of peace, okay? Sitting beside garden, so peaceful and so still. A house and garden given to us by the artist Derek Hill. What is the answer? Text or WhatsApp your answer. Text or WhatsApp your answer, name and address to 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. And just to let you know that the theme for National Heritage Week 2024 is Connections, Roots and Networks, celebrating how we connect to each other and the connections that bring us together. So text or WhatsApp your answer, name and address to 086 60 25000, and the clue is a house and garden given, sitting beside garden, so peaceful and so still, a house and garden given to us by the artist Derek Hill. What is the answer? Text us 086 60 25000 or email comments at highlandradio.com. Now, just to let you know that next month I am, we mentioned this with Lee Gooch, and I want to be careful not to over push this, but at the same time to push it, right? So next month, the Donegal Camino is taking place. Noel Cunningham is behind that, of course. He's very involved in the Cancer Care West Donegal charity. It's an amazing charity. We all know that, don't we? Or we will find out. That's just the nature of cancer. And when the help is there when we need it, it's a remarkable service they provide. So many people have availed of it. So many of our family members have availed of it as well. And it's inconspicuous. It's down there in Letterkenny, and people call in and get the services and the benefits that they need. We were down there for a show, and it was amazing. And speaking to people who've used the services, it's amazing the impact it had on them. And it was also really interesting, this the mood down there, right? It was a mood of hope and a mood of support and stuff. Don't know how to phrase it, but I think you know what I'm saying. Now, I've never done this before. I probably won't do it too often, but I'm going to take part in part of the Donegal Camino, and I'm going to try through my social media and through this show to ask you to be as generous as possible, if you can afford anything at all, to support me in this walk and actually to support Donegal Cancer, Cancer Care West Donegal. And I've an iDonate Me page, believe it or not. It's iDonate.ie/Greg Hughes. Simple as that. iDonate.ie/Greg Hughes. And if you could donate anything, and people have already been so incredibly generous, if you can donate anything, or maybe you're a business and you want to, and I'll give you a plug, don't worry about that. If you want to support Donegal Cancer Care West, please go on to that link, iDonate.ie/Greg Hughes. It's at the top of my social media if you want to search out Greg Hughes there, and anything at all would be so greatly appreciated. And we'll try and have a bit of fun with it too, loads of pictures, maybe videos and stuff from the day itself. We're only launching it today. We don't really know where it's going to go from here, but Noel Cunningham's going to join us about 10:30 just to remind us of the important work of that amazing centre, but also to hopefully help you, encourage you to dig deep. Right, okay. So idonate.ie/Greg Hughes. It's really quite simple, and I'd really, really appreciate any support. As I say, I've never asked before, so if you have a spare fiver or a tenner or whatever it might be, please, your support would be greatly appreciated. Okay, the Polestar, it's going to be immortalised on a stamp, or is in fact. We're going to talk about that after this short break. The Polestar, installed in Letterkenny in 2006, has been chosen to be immortalised on a stamp. Its creator, Lockie Morris, is with us now. Good morning, Lockie.
Morning.
Right. How does it feel to see your work immortalised on a stamp?
Yeah, it was a really lovely surprise. Lovely surprise, I've got to say. I can't deny that. So, no, it's, sort of thing might happen to you when you're dead, you know. So, it's happening, and I'm very grateful.
Talk to us about the concept of it. of this and its inception and design?
Yeah, probably competition, you know, as these things are. So you do respond to a brief, you know, and you look at the brief and see what people are interested in. You might, you know, the history of the area, or, you know, there's a couple of railway bridges that pass there and no longer there, you know, and then there's Port Ballyrain. Well, the port's not really there anymore, but they used to deliver goods just right beside the, it used to be called Port Ballyrain Roundabout, you know. Mm-hmm. So I kind of read about that and then tried to respond to that, you know, in an artwork in some way, you know. So those were the kind of themes that I had in mind, you know, when I was trying to come up with a design. But at a certain point, you have to leave those things aside and then try and dream something up, you know. So I started wondering. The idea that the electricity, the poles for the electricity, electrification of rural Ireland during the 40s and 50s would have been landed there, right beside where the roundabout is now. So I thought, you know, my first thought was, I wonder, could I do anything with poles, electricity poles? And that was a starting point, you know, and I made a very, very small model out of cocktail sticks to begin with, you know, and then I sort of built it up from there, and I looked at the form, and I thought, oh, that looks like a nice form. I wonder, could that stand up?
When you were designing it, did you want it to sort of tell a different story or have a different look from each approach, or was your focus on traffic coming into Letterkenny? Obviously, it seems to face that way, but you could argue, and this is open to the viewer, I suppose, you could argue that it's a different picture regardless of which way you approach the roundabout.
Yeah. When I come up with the design, you know, and I thought, oh, wait, it is a stage thing, because you're speculating on things, and because it's a unique thing, that's not been done before. You make decisions along the way as you go along. You make one decision and another decision. I mean, I remember down with Mark Hill would have been the guy that built it, and then Dennis Doherty from Bunkland, he also built it. I mean, I just laboured on it, really, you know, so these were two construction geniuses, you know,
yeah.
People that are really good at their things. But I remember, you know, Mark being on the roundabout with the model, you know, this was before it was there, and I'm trying to figure out which is the best position for this, you know, and then turn around a bit, you know. I was on phones, turn around. That's about it, you know, with the model, you know. So that wasn't, you know, as I say, you take it stage at a time. But yeah, so four different views are good, and then you're trying to get that view, that main view, when you're coming up the road, you know, that port road, and you can sort of see the circle and the sky in the background. So yeah.
And also, what it reminds me of many different things, but there's some quite famous pictures of Bad Eddy, a boat I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
You know, just the way some of the poles strut out there. Talks to the boating history of that area too, I presume. It's not an accident.
Yeah, no, you know, you do, as I say, you try to absorb what people are asking, you know, about the railways and the history of the area and the history of the port, and then, like, you try and absorb those things, and then you hope that those things are referenced. I mean, it's an abstract thing, but it does seem to reference all these different things, and it wasn't deliberate, you know, it wasn't really, I wasn't coming out, I wasn't super conscious of that. You just start to make things with a model in real life, and then things turn up, surprises turn up, and go, oh, look, that looks quite railway-like, it looks quite boat-like. Mm-hmm. It's got all these kind of resonances to it, you know. I thought, well, I could be onto something here, you know. So that was as much a surprise to me, you know, as to people when they see it, you know.
And the circular shape, was that sort of just something that came through design and looked pretty?
It came with the design, you know. I thought, I'll start off with triangles, you know. They're quite strong structural shape. As a kid, I used to make triangles with lollipop sticks and turn them into little things you could fly. You know, like I used to watch those kung fu films where they had these things and they flew each other as boys. You know, so I used to make them as a wee kid. So I just tried out triangles. It really was. You start off playing, really.
For me, I'm not artistic, but obviously, you know, when you're talking about the past and you're talking about rail and you talk about boat, there then becomes sort of like a portal element to it, if you know what I mean, the circular shape, if you wanted to think down that route.
That's right. It's a directional thing. I mean, obviously, roundabouts are all about direction, you know, which way you're going to go round. And also, it references that, you know, and the name came up halfway through it. I thought, poles and then star. Well, it's got that, you know, that sort of traffic directions, sort of that, yeah, not sci-fi, yeah. But that kind of like sci-fi, and it's sort of like the stars, and you're kind of something to, I don't know, steer yourself.
One other thing I was curious about is the scale, right? So when this was being put out there and submissions were being sought, were you given an idea of the scale? Because if you weren't, you would think, right, I'm actually asking them to build this out of 104 timber poles and it's going to be 12 metres high. You know, they could have just gone for, a tin man on a tin horse or something like that there. But were you given an idea of how big it was allowed to be? So as
I think that they had a competition before and they didn't get anything. They were looking for a landmark. They were looking for something landmark, you know. And the budget, well, the budget wasn't, you know, it just sort of, you kind of speculate on something. I wonder could I make this? I mean, I think at the start I had maybe 260, you know, poles in it. And I thought, now when I went to do it, I thought, you know, going, God, that's far too many and they're too thin. You know, it needs to be thicker so you can see it, so it has more substance, so it's got more presence, you know, on the thing. So you've got, it's a very big roundabout, you know, so you've got, if you stick a small thing on there, it's just, you're not going to see it, you know, so you're having to play around with all those things, you know, so... Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I give it to them, and it says, well, and so, but no, Donegal County Council, Letterkenny County Council, and all the people were completely behind it, you know. I make a presentation to a group of people and convince them that this thing could be made, even though the best, you know, it is a speculation, you're thinking, because you have to kind of trust on people that you're going to do your best to try to realise it. So, but they were very... They could not be any more behind it, you know, and that's really a really important thing when you're doing something like this, you know.
And also, too, you also have the, you know, I mean, we have a lot of artists and, the you know, they have their art in galleries or on shows and you try and encourage people to get in and you discount them getting in.
Yeah.
You're in the situation where, whether people like it or not, you've got an audience that is captivated because they're sitting looking at it as they wait 10 minutes to get into Letterkenny. So that's a bonus as well.
That is an absolute bonus. I mean, that's something where people stop you, you know, because it's so public, and that's why it can be so painful if people don't like it or whatever. But it's you can't go on, like Rick Rubin, the great producer, says, you know, art has to split opinion, you know, a good art has to split opinion.
But I don't really think it's split that opinion, and it's instantly become a landmark, instantly. You know, sometimes things sort of have to grow and... people have different. This is the Polestar roundabout, and that's the Polestar, and it is just that. And just then, finally, I mean, obviously, stamps aren't as significant as they once were, but in a way, it is. They still remain incredibly significant, particularly sort of in recognizing, you know, culture or influential people or influential installations. So it still is a big deal for your work to be immortalized, and it is immortalized forever. On a stamp, it's really lovely. I think it's a lovely thing.
All right, thank you. I'm over the moon about it. It's fantastic,
Fantastic too. Listen, great to chat to you. Actually, to just get a bit of a bit of an insight into the thinking behind it all. It's been lovely speaking to you, Lockie.
No, thanks for having me.
All right, take care of yourself. Bye bye. That's Lockie Morris, the creator of the Polestar Roundabout, reacting to the great news that it's up since 2006. Can you imagine? Reacting to the great news that it is to be immortalised on a stamp. What do you think of that? Great news, I think. 08660 25,000. Right, it is the 9 till noon show. Coming up in the next hour will be Community Garda information. It is Tuesday, of course, so we've got Community Garda information for you, where you will hear the latest appeals and information from An Garda Síochána Síochána here live and first on Highland Radio. So tune in for that. If you want to watch that, you can hop on YouTube or Facebook. You're more than welcome to do that, and you can see what's going on as well. Also, Noel Cunningham will join us a little later on as we talk about the Donegal Camino, looking for as many of you as possible to get involved in that, and also maybe to help me rattle the bucket for our little fundraiser we're running on this show. That and so much more besides. But stand by, we're going to take a break now for the news and obituary notices, and then we'll return with all of that just after 10.